We closed our eyes, we counted to 30, and then we opened our eyes, and there they were. Our eyes had adjusted, and it was almost like flying over Los Angeles. There were so many little lights.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. For her latest project, author Georgianne Eubanks found herself bathing in a Virginia forest, afloat in the midst of the Okefenokee Swamp, and a dozen places in between. She documented those journeys in a new book called The Fabulous Ordinary. In it, you'll encounter everything from the massive elk of the North Carolina mountains to the tiny gnat larvae that light up an Alabama canyon at night. You'll run across cranes and swans and bald eagles. And you'll even hear frogs that might be in your backyard right now. Georgianne talked to me about not just the animals and plants she saw, but the history of the places where they live and the fascinating people who look after them in all the little pockets of the Wild South. Here's our conversation. Georgianne Eubanks, this book, did it start out as a series of trips that became a book idea, or did it start out as a book idea that turned into a series of trips?
Wow, I think it probably started with a couple of trips. One was going to see the tundra swans and snow geese in eastern North Carolina, in that big flat place, Lake Pungo, where they gather in November until January every year, thousands and thousands of these birds. And I was lucky enough to go with Tom Earnhardt and some other friends from around the state. And we were so impressed. And Donna Campbell, who's the photographer for the book, you know, we said, we should find some more places, some more events like this. And this was as we were working on the previous book, which was called Saving the Wild South, and it was about endangered plants. And one thing I learned in doing that book was that kids need more experience in nature. They need to get out from behind the screens and physically visit places where they can become comfortable and wowed by nature. And so the mission of this book turned into offering opportunities for parents and grandparents to take kids, if they had them, to go themselves with friends and to revisit nature. And of course, COVID was happening when we started thinking about this. And people got more interested in birding and getting out on trails because they could when the virus was active. So it was a kind of a, you know, coalescence of those things.
Yeah, and did you end up at some point just kind of making a list of stuff you wanted to see? How did the stuff that ended up in the book, how did that come about?
Well, I wanted there to be a variety. I didn't want it to be all birds or all mammals or all amphibians. So I was also thinking originally about trying to engage all the senses. So I wanted sounds, I wanted sights, I wanted curious opportunities to learn about animals that you don't see very often, like the bugling elk in the Smokies. What a strange sound that is.
Just to catch people up on that, the elk had basically disappeared from this part of the world and were reintroduced up in the North Carolina mountains. And those are the ones you saw over by the Cherokee Reservation, right?
That's right. That's right. The first one we saw was actually walking down the sidewalk in front of the high school in Cherokee.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, I want to get, you mentioned the tundra swans, the birds. You sort of bracket the book. This book sort of roughly follows a calendar year.
Right.
And you bracket it with these two birds that I don't think most people might not know spend time in the South, and those are the tundra swans that you saw in North Carolina, and also sandhill cranes that you saw in Alabama, and sort of explain how they end up where they do during that time of the year.
Yeah, well, they mate in the north, in the very cold part of, they come all the way up to Siberia. And it's true for both the sandhill cranes and the swans. They make a stop on the flyway, in the case of the sandhill cranes, about as far east as they come is in Alabama. There are some sandhill cranes that live in Florida year round, which, you know, like other people go to Florida and stay.
Like Canada geese that just never go anywhere, right?
Right, right. I had never seen a sandhill crane up close, so that was an extraordinary opportunity. And the Wheeler Wildlife Refuge has been present, was built in the WPA era when the TVA dammed the Tennessee River there. But it wasn't really until the 2000s that the sandhill cranes made that part of their flight path.
Yeah, and then in North Carolina, the, like you said, Pungo Lake, the tundra swans and snow geese.
November to January they come. So they arrive in November. They come to that part of North Carolina because it's one of the darkest places left on the eastern seaboard. And the farmers in that part of the state plant generous crops for them and expect them to have about 20% of their crop yield will go to the birds.
I guess I had a general idea that happened. I did not understand until I read your book and saw Donna Campbell's photo that they were there in such incredible numbers.
Yeah, it's just incredible to see. We happened to be there one day when the wind was blowing such that the birds were on the far side of Pungo Lake. So they were just a white stripe in the distance, almost a solid white stripe on the edge of the water. And then suddenly a hawk or a bald eagle flew over and spooked them, and they all took off at once. And that white band suddenly became sort of like chalk marks in the sky. It was extraordinary. But they do hang out for several months. They leave after the first full moon in February, and they go back to Siberia and Greenland, and they mate. But they just hang out and eat and enjoy each other in North Carolina. And there are a few sandhill cranes actually among the group that you can see if you know what you're looking for.
Almost literal snowbirds, right?
That's right.
Beyond the birds that we may know about or may not know spent time in the South, there are also some creatures in this book that I didn't know about or never even heard of. Could you please explain to folks what Dismalites are?
Yes, yes. Well, they actually are much more widespread than we know, because not very many people get out in the dark without flashlights in dense woods and look for these little glowing creatures. But they are gnat larvae, and they tend to be housed in moss that's wet. And in Alabama, in Phil Campbell, Alabama, which is far west, there is Dismal's Canyon. And that's where we went on our somewhat perilous climb down into the canyon in the afternoon just to sort of see the place. But then we went back after dark with a guide who promptly fell flat on his face in the dark. And it did not inspire confidence. But he took us to a couple of just beautiful spots where these larvae were glowing blue dots on the side of the rocks. And we all had infrared flashlights, but we turned them off. We closed our eyes. We counted to 30. And then we opened our eyes. And there they were. Our eyes had adjusted. And it was almost like flying over Los Angeles. There were so many little lights from the ground all the way up the rocks and to the sky, where, of course, it was a starlit night. And there were lightning bugs, too. So it was quite an experience.
You mentioned kind of in passing that it was a little bit of a perilous journey there, you know, going down into that canyon. Well, first in the day it was rough enough, and then in the dark as well. It felt like that you and Donna, the photographer, put yourselves in some sort of dicey spots along the way. I know it sounded like you were a little worried as you guys were chasing alligators through the Okefenokee.
Yeah.
That there were a couple of places you were a little worried about getting out, right?
Yep. I didn't want to get out of the car. We at the Okefenokee, we went to a place that's known as where the alligators tend to congregate. And it's a fishing spot, and people go and cast their lines. And often the alligators, if you catch a fish, the alligator gets it before you can reel it in. So we've been sort of warned, you know, don't tease the alligators, don't get too close to the alligators, and you might want to pick another place to fish. But we saw 16 alligators lined up on the side of this channel of water. And they were in various stages of sleeping or holding their mouths open and catching mosquitoes in their mouths. It was pretty crazy. And one lady drove in and she said, do you think I could camp along here tonight? And I was like, did you see the alligators when you drove in? And she said, what alligators? And I thought, you better not camp here tonight. And you better not walk your little dog here either.
One thing I didn't realize, I mean, I grew up not too far from the Okefenokee, but I didn't realize until reading it in your book that they've sort of traced the genealogy of a lot of the gators there, right? Like they see them in the swamp and they kind of know who they are and know who their offspring are and all that sort of thing, the wildlife people who work down there.
There is sort of a tension among scientists about naming animals because they want to, you know, have them be scientific specimens. But in fact, in the Okefenokee, they have done genealogies of male and female alligators and marked their territory and tried to understand their breeding habits and their, you know, best habitat. And so there are lots of alligators that go by different names down there. And our friend Phoebe Carnes, who photographs the elk in Cherokee, also has named a number of the elk. And some of the national park guys think that's a little silly, but it helps her communicate, she says, with visitors and say, now this is Chippy, and Chippy has a very unusual chipped horn. And then here's Gustavo, who really wants to replace Chippy, but he's still the junior partner in this clan.
It's interesting to me the way you structure this book. There's a sort of a moment where in each chapter you're talking about basically what animal or creature you've gone off to see. But then you get a little bit into the history of each creature and the place that you're at. And often those histories obviously they're intertwined, have a lot to do with each other. Can you think of a place or a animal's history in this book that really like surprised you or something you didn't know about maybe before you started delving in?
Yeah, I had never seen a wood stork before, and they're amazing creatures, large, very solemn. I called them priest-like in the book. That chapter is probably the most layered and complicated because the land that we were on at one time was a plantation that belonged to one of the most notorious white supremacists. He was a governor of South Carolina, a senator who was accused of sexual abusing his nieces. He was a character. His plantation house is still there. Well, it happens to be also the land where the Savannah River plant is very close by. And the wood stork started migrating farther and farther north with a changing climate. And they were feeding in the cooling ponds of one of the nuclear plants at the Savannah River, which was closed down. It was shut down. But the folks at the facility decided they were going to reinvigorate this nuclear plant. And they called the Audubon Society, which had a piece of land that at once belonged to this notorious politician. And they were trying to convert it to be quail property where people could go shoot quail. But the feds said, would you please reinvigorate the mill ponds so that the wood storks will come to your place. If you bait them with some great fish, maybe they'll stop coming over here and we can turn on our nuclear power plant. What a conservation weird story. And now we went to an event they call Corks and Storks at this Audubon Preserve, where the fellow who runs the preserve puts out lots and lots of food for the wood storks to get large numbers of them to be there on that day. And they put out a great spread of fried chicken and pimento cheese and wine for the people who come to the fundraiser. And then everybody gets fed, and we all go look at the wood storks at the pond. It was.
That interplay between, the environment, the natural world, and the human world comes up again and again. And you mentioned earlier the Itchituckni River in North Florida, which, for people who don't know, is this spectacular spring-fed, 72 degrees, cool, crystal clear river that I know of is for people who go tubing a lot. But you kind of talked about the history of that place, and it seems like through its entire history, people did their best to destroy that place.
Absolutely.
And like explain what some of the things that happened there.
Well, they did phosphate mining there. People back in the day would drive their cars right up to the bank to go swimming. And I guess cars didn't have very good parking brakes back then. And often the car would roll into the river. People who were cropping tobacco on the shores down toward the end of the river would come and wash themselves after a day of being in the tobacco fields. Cows were allowed there until the 80s. They cut all the cedar trees and sent them to be made into pencils. It was just one thing after another. And now, some 250,000 people tube on that river, mostly young people. It's a rite of passage in the area to go down the river, but they are extremely strict in preventing people from bringing anything that could become trash. I would not, given the alligators, young little alligators we saw, I would not be sitting in an inner tube on that river. I was glad to be in a canoe, but thousands of kids go and do that.
The one thing you, when you listed all those things, the thing that popped out to me that you didn't mention was people used to dynamite for fish in there. They
Oh
used to
gosh,
like
yeah.
literally throw dynamite in the river and blow it up so that fish would float to the top, right?
Right. And they'd have fish cookouts right on the banks. And in fact, we saw mullet that I felt like I could just reach out and grab right on beside the canoe swimming with us.
And just to kind of complete the circle on that, y'all went to the Itchituckni looking for river otters, right?
That's right. That's
And
right.
it sounded like it was a little dicey about whether you're actually going to see any or not.
Well, it was a writer's dream. You know how you want some suspense and you and mystery. And we were certainly not positive that we would find the otters, although I think our guide, who is the state park ranger there, who's been there 28 years and manages all those children in inner tubes, he said, "Well, we may not see any, but I saw five or seven of them yesterday." So it was at the very end of our ride that we saw them, and they were most cooperative. We were able to get really close to them and take photographs from the canoe, which was a thrill. I'd never really I've seen a weasel in Colorado, but I'd never seen a river otter, and certainly, being as close as we were, we could see them eating their crayfish. They would come up on the log and show off what they had just caught and then sit there and crunch it to death.
That reminded me, thinking about how you didn't know if you were going to see one or not. Did you have trips or creatures you went to see where they all just kind of struck out?
Yes, we did try to go to what is now known as an owl prowl. Some state and federal parks will host an evening event where you, in the case of the one we went to, and I won't disclose where because it was kind of embarrassing for the leaders, they brought stuffed owls so that we could see them up close, what they looked like. And then when darkness fell, we went to the very edge of the border of the park And these fellows played on a little speaker. They played owls calling, hoping that we would attract owls. Well, we heard the recording, and then we'd hear this faint owl in the distance. And after about three times of getting excited, we realized the owl that was answering was also on the recording, not in the woods. So we didn't have any luck that night. But we later found a gentleman, a retired a pathologist, actually, who has done a survey of an entire county in the mountains of Virginia and knows where all the eastern screech owls are. And it took him about 2 seconds to bring three of them right to us.
When we come back, Georgia Ann Eubanks talks about how she inherited a love of the wilderness.
When she died, my aunt sort of elbowed me and said, as her coffin was before us, he said, "Your grandmother could tell you the name of every flower on top of her coffin in its Latin name and its common name."
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Georgia Ann Eubanks. Another feature I think of this book is, with almost all these animals, creatures that you write about, there's somebody there who is sort of their champion.
Yes.
Or somebody who's sort of, I don't know if obsessed is the right word, but at least they're very enthusiastic about this particular thing, and they're often the ones who are showing y'all around. Are there one or two of those folks that you thought were like especially kind of delightful or entertaining?
When I wrote Saving the Wild South, I was traveling and doing talks at various conservation groups and book clubs. And I met a biologist in Georgia named Erin Cork. And she's crazy about frogs and crazy about snakes. And she told me, her talk was very compelling. She described the sound of different frogs with these wonderful metaphors, like, "This frog sounds like somebody rubbing a wet balloon with their fingers." And I was so tickled by her descriptions. Or, "This frog sounds like a bus full of sheep." So I thought she was very clever. Well, it turned out that she had finally reached a point in life, I think she's maybe in her early 40s, that she could buy a house. And so she went out to look with a realtor out in the country, south of Savannah. And the realtor took her and said, "Now, we're going to a place right now. It's in your price range, but it's kind of near a water treatment plant. I'm not sure the air is going to smell good. It's very low property and wet." And so they pulled in the driveway and Erin jumped out of the car. And the first thing she saw on the back steps of the house was a little spadefoot toad. And she was so excited, she took off into the woods to look around the house while the realtor was standing on the porch going, "Do you want to see inside the house?" And she bought the place because she knew she was buying a bog of frogs and snakes.
She got her frogs and the house didn't matter as much, I guess.
No, and she's still posting on Facebook what she's finding.
So speaking of frogs, one of the chapters in this book is a little different than the others in that instead of like going way out in the woods or down a canyon or something like that looking for these creatures, you basically found them in your backyard. And these are the frogs that are, I guess, in a retention pond where you live. Is that right?
That's right. I live in Carrboro, which is a very green, friendly community. And we have a bioretention pond to hold all the water, stormwater runoff on our property. And I came home one May evening and there was a symphony back there. And I recorded the symphony and I sent it to Erin and I asked her, who am I listening to here? And she named three species of frogs that she could hear on my phone recording. Now, part of that, Tommy, was wanting to do some do-it-yourself chapters. So we also have an opportunity for people to hang up a sheet on their house and attract moths and identify the moths. I wanted some of these to be really easy for kids, and the moth thing or the frog thing are perfect for a sleepover.
Yeah, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that part of your goal, and not just in this book, but kind of as a what you do for a living, is to get people out in the woods more, and especially kids, right?
Yes. And so there's a lot around us. And once you hear a green tree frog or a peeper, you're going to know it when you hear it again. And Donna and I found ourselves driving through after we'd been to the Okefenokee, just low places in Georgia. We'd hear them through the window and stop and roll down the window and hear the spring peepers carrying on. It was fun.
So I wanted to ask a little bit about kind of how all this happened for you in the first place. Where you mentioned in the book a few times about trips you took with your family, you were kids, and seeing wildlife and that sort of thing. Has this always been like something you've been really interested in and care about a lot?
I had a friend tell me about 30 years ago that I get a lot of energy out of being in nature, and I went, oh, I think that's true. And I have a cabin in the Blue Ridge Mountains that I love very much and have been going there since 1990. It is second nature. My grandparents, who, and I'll give a little plug, I have a poetry collection that's just come out. And that book is called Rural Astronomy. And it's a lot about my grandparents and what they taught me in terms of plants and animals. My grandmother was, when she died, my aunt sort of elbowed me and said, as her coffin was before us, he said, your grandmother could tell you the name of every flower on top of her coffin in its Latin name and its common name. She was an expert, and she was a country woman from North Georgia. My grandfather was an orphan from Eastern Alabama, but they both loved nature and they planted and cultivated and grew vegetables and grew flowers for the church. And I think, that was my milieu as a kid. And my father bought 5 acres of land on a gravel road that now is in urban Atlanta. But at the time, we had fox and deer and all kinds of animals that would come through our yard.
What's your cabin in the Blue Ridge like in terms of what you see, natural stuff up there?
The sad news is, Tommy, that we lost about half of the trees on the property with Hurricane Helene. I was just up there this weekend and I can't get used to the amount of sunlight now. We lost a 150-year-old cherry tree that was shading the cabin and the yard, and now I'm growing sun perennials all of a sudden. Everything's changed.
You've been paying attention to this stuff for a long time. One of the tensions in this book and in your work is sort of what people have done to the land versus how they've tried to rescue it in various ways. So you talk about your family land is now urban Atlanta, and so much of the places that many of us went to see when we were younger are now gone or via either things like climate change or human development. But also, these elk that were basically extinct in this part of the world are now back and pretty much thriving. You talked about whooping cranes that make an appearance or two in this book that were down to like double digits, 42 left in the and now, I don't know if thriving is the right word, but they're certainly in greater numbers than there used to be. Like, how do you kind of see that push and pull that's happened kind of in your lifetime?
Well, it breaks my heart, and I think that's part of what led me to this work. And it's been a great joy to meet people who are doing the work they're doing in the field to preserve species, to protect areas. And, the South is so biodiverse still, and we've got to hang on to that because it is our identity. It's how we know ourselves is these plants that grow here. They're a big part of who we are. They're a big part of our culture. Look at the magazines that come out of the South. There's always plants and trees, and hunting is a big practice. It is so much a part of who we are. All sorts of people and people who've moved here tend to appreciate my books because they're learning about the riches of the area. So we've got to hang on. But unfortunately, it's like a little islands all over where just junk patches of original native plants are thriving. And then you go and there's habitat destruction. And as I heard recently, a woman who's spent her entire life saving the turtles on Cumberland Island, she says, Mother Nature always bats last. And I've come to believe that. I have to believe that. I'd rather Mother Nature win than us.
To just ask kind of the big overarching question, after doing all this, after taking all these trips and writing about all this, what do you think you ended up learning about maybe not just the Wild South, but about yourself and your own life kind of in the woods?
I do take a lot of energy from my time, and I have become. I spent the last weekend pulling weeds, and it's almost an obsession. But the cabin took a hit, a bad hit. Lots of trees down. Then people came and removed the timber and ruined my flower beds and the vegetable garden. And so there's a lot to recover. I'm not as fit or young as I used to be, but I want to do that as much as anything, is to keep that land. But here's the one thing that has happened. I'm much more tolerant of the wildness of it. I don't have to have everything perfectly organized in the garden. I like the wilder look. And I met a woman in Georgia a few weeks ago on book tour who took me to see her nursery. She sells native plants in Georgia, and she said, I used to have the garden club ladies here and show them the gardens, and now I show them the wildscape. And that's really kind of where she's gone with it, partly because of age, partly because we can't control everything with climate change, and partly because it's actually just fine to be wild.
Georgia Ann Eubanks' book serves as an excellent travel guide. I know I'm going to follow her lead and go look at those tundra swans down east next time I get a chance. But it's also a reminder that the Wild South is not just some remote wilderness. It's a Storkhaven next to a nuclear site. It's an elk stomping ground near the Cherokee Visitor Center. It might even be frogs in the Conda Retention Pond. If we pay attention, it's easy to see that wildlife finds a way to exist, even among the concrete and metal of the city. Birds flock to skyscraper lights to feed on insects. Chipmunks and squirrels dart through the bushes on the sidewalk. The untamed world is always right there at our fingertips. That's a comfort, at least for me. Despite all that human beings have done to strip and pave and pollute, the wild world thrives anyway. And when we take the time to see it up close, it is even more primal and beautiful than we might have remembered. As Georgia Ann's book title says, both ordinary and fabulous. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Eli Portillo and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.